Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 22 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I welcome my friend, a professional genealogist, Jen Baldwin. Jen is the North American Content Manager and Global Ambassador Program Lead for Find My Past. Well, Jen, welcome to Conversations with Kenyatta. I appreciate you being here. We've known each other for quite some time. Had a lot of genealogy adventures together at conferences and weddings and other things. So I'm excited to connect with you on genealogy and Find My Past. So my first question to you is, what is Find My Past and how long have you been with the organization?
Yeah, Kenyatta, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate this and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Find My Past. Find My Past is a genealogy subscription service, very similar to other websites and products that we're all accustomed to out there in our family history research. We're a fast-growing company that is based in the UK. So our main office is in London, England. And then we have a secondary office in Dundee, Scotland, which is a lot of fun for me being based in the United States. I'm in Colorado, so I'm 7 hours behind my colleagues, which is great because my mornings are filled with meetings and then my afternoons are just work time, which is really nice, right? So we have billions of digitized records available on the website and access to some of the world's most renowned historical databases. We really are attempting to allow customers and the community to connect with themselves, past and present, mm-hmm. to visualize their family story in detail and in a way that isn't available and hasn't been done before. And really mm-hmm. the home of British and Irish heritage. So if you have ancestors in Britain, England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, including Northern Ireland, you really want to take a look at Find My Past and the record collections that we have available on the site.
And I want to just ask you to, if you can, give a little bit more information around the visual piece of Find My Past. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, so we're starting actually on acquiring a number of photographic collections. That's one element in which we're really starting to grow and try and offer an opportunity that's unique. So we have a handful of collections actually for the UK that are really early photographies and some really significant photography collections, thousands of images from everyday life across England and Wales and Scotland and Ireland. So you might see photographs of the local parish or the local high street or women just strolling through the park with their children and police officers standing on the corner. So all sorts of different kind of pieces of just regular life. What would your ancestors have seen as they were walking through their village or their town? That's what we're trying to capture. And those come from a number of different repositories and archives, but you can also find materials in terms of illustrations, newspaper images, sketches before photography was mass available. So there are drawings, for example, across Ireland, kind of country scenes of Ireland, right? What we all picture, that rolling green hills, those are all readily available, but they include things like, you know, bridges and parish buildings and really kind of these iconic moments captured visually in some sense. We're also doing a lot on our app just to bring things to the future. So a lot of photographic tools, colorization and photo collections in terms of corrections. Also, the ability to scan an image, for example, of a group of people. Maybe you have a wedding photo, for example, and the app will automatically pick up each face and you can tag them and add that individual cropped picture to your tree. So a lot of tools on the app that are in production now and coming to mass market really soon.
That sounds great. I want to know, I'm very intrigued. I've always been intrigued by your role and by my past. Because I want to know, what exactly does a North American content manager do? Like, in genealogy, what does that mean?
That means I touch just about everything that has to do with North America, right? For the business. No, really, my job description boils down to, I identify historical record collections from North America and contract with those archives to actually digitize them and make them available on the website. So some good examples of that would be the New York Archdiocese Sacramento Registers, right? I work hand in hand with the archives and their archivist to make sure that that project is scanned, that the records are transcribed, and that they're published on the website in a timely manner. I also get a chance to do a lot of research. So I'm out there in the field digging around in archives and repositories when I can to say, like, you know, this collection would be great for the Find My Past community, or this collection maybe not so much. So I get real hands-on with a lot of the materials that we publish, which obviously is delightful for any genealogist.
Well, Jen, your job sounds fantastic, especially for a genealogist. Being able to go to collections, make those decisions about which collections are digitized and transcribed, and being able to do that hands-on work that we really love when you can. But one of the things, me as an attorney, of course, that interests me is you say that you contract, you know, with these archives to decide. So what exactly does that mean, if you can share that information?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, and this is standard across the industry, actually. So you kind of, you know, you walk in the door and you say, hey, archive, we would really like to digitize your materials. What is it going to take to make that happen? At Find My Past, we're very open about those relationships. Some of those relationships we've had for a number of years. The British Library is a great example. The National Archives in the UK is another good example, where we've been working with them for over a decade. And so those contracts are relatively standard, but we do kind of open the door to say, what is it that you need, right? Some archives want financial compensation for their records. Some archives just want them to be digitized, and they don't want to pay for it, or they don't want to actually go through the process of the digitization itself, because it is a difficult and challenging process in some cases. So negotiating those contracts is actually, for me, one of the most rewarding pieces, because I can walk into an archive, whether it's a major facility or even just a small local genealogical society, and say, what is it that you need to grow and to be successful as an organization? How can Find My Past help you to get that? So we have a number of different types of relationships where we, you know, maybe just are the digital arm of that organization. We publish their materials that are already in PDF format because they don't have the website presence or the technical know-how or help to actually keep that website up and running. And we can kind of do that for them. But in some cases, it is a full conservation, scanning, and indexing of a vast collection. And that, of course, is a more complicated relationship, but equally rewarding. It really depends on how the archive perceives the partnership and what is of best benefit for both parties. So Find My Past obviously has a strategy and a business plan that we are trying to adhere to, but the archives in our communities, the societies, the libraries, they all have a need as well. And so the idea here is, how can we build a long-term relationship that really is beneficial for more than just 1 or 2 years, right? We're really looking at a 10-year or longer relationship is kind of the ideal scenario for us.
Great. Well, thanks for explaining that, because I think, you know, we all kind of wonder as we research these collections, how do they decide, you know, what becomes part of their strategy and their collection for their website? So it's like peeling back the curtain a little bit.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. Appreciate that. Yeah. And I think, you know, from that corporate standpoint, just to add one more thought, when you look at historical collections that are available on some of these mass market websites, it's really about size and scope, but thinking about, you know, this collection may have 100% of the population in the year 1920 for that county. Every single person was recorded. Well, that matters to us just as much as this collection over here that captures 50% of the adult population for an entire nation. So there's a lot of variables.
And we appreciate that, right, for as genealogists, because whether you have 100% or a small percent of the population represented in a collection, we can find our person, right, or at least have the opportunity to, which is what we want to do. So my next question for you, though, is, what is the Global Ambassador Program at Find My Past. It sounds very official. So I'd like to learn more about it.
Yeah, so about 18 months ago, Find My Past launched essentially an influencer marketing program with our community, especially in areas of the world where we have a really significant historic presence, but maybe not as much brand recognition as we would like. So the idea here is that we took people who are well known in their space, who are experts in their area, and asked them to share more about Find My Past. And they do get a little bit of compensation in exchange for that. They get a free subscription, for example, to the website. And we launched this program a year and a half ago or so in Australia and New Zealand. So we had a group of people who we specifically asked to write blog posts or include us in their lectures, just to make sure that their communities, their societies, the people who recognize them as experts in their field also know that Find My Past is a great resource. And obviously the historical connection between England, where the vast majority of our records are, and a location like Australia, right, is very obvious for anybody who knows just about anything about history. You know, the idea of really targeting some of these areas of the world where, you know, we don't necessarily have TV commercials playing all the time, but there are plenty of people out there who use Find My Past and use it daily that can speak as a brand advocate on our behalf just as well as we could. And in some cases, probably do it better than us, really.
Yeah, I think with that point, you know, hearing from the researcher, from the genealogist, from the person using the collection and their experience with the collection resonates so much more with researchers than kind of getting that corporate message, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's a question of trust too, right? You know, if you were to say to your listeners, Find My Past is a great website, they'll probably believe you over me because they don't know who I am, right? They don't know me, but they've invested in you as an expert in your field, right? I've never written any books, but I know that I can recommend Kenyatta's book to just about anybody I talk to, right? Because she is an expert in that. I get that. It works in all directions, right? So Find My Past, we don't have an Australian history expert on staff at Find My Past, but we have Australian ambassadors that can speak to that topic and incorporate the Find My Past collection in an appropriate way.
That's great. So speaking of collections, I want to get to some of the unique collections that are available on Find My Past. Some of the things that folks listening are like, I've never tried Find My Past, but I'm intrigued. What are some of the things that stand out, especially that you've acquired or been close to in your role?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch, actually, of materials that I really like to talk about when this question is posed to me. And it is one of the most common questions I get, right? What makes Find My Past different? What makes you special? Why should I try you? My generic answer to that is we all know in family history, we should try everything, right? There is no stone that we should leave unturned. So we would invite you to give Find My Past a shot. But there are a couple of collections in particular that I am particularly proud of. The Catholic Record Collection is one of those, the Catholic Heritage Archive, which includes Sacramento registers from across the UK, but also includes the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Chicago. And those are all completely published and available on Find My Past, with the exception of New York, the Archdiocese of New York. We're still in the process of scanning. But there's a lot of fun collections as well. I think, you know, when, like, for example, with Irish research, Irish genealogy is notoriously difficult. Find My Past does have the largest online collection of Irish records available today. And that includes a number of collections that we have published very intentionally to try and be census substitutes and substitutes for vital records, because so much was lost in Ireland. So a good example of that actually is the Irish dog license registers. They, you know, at some point they created a tax for anybody who owned a dog. And just like today, I have to go register my dog and my cat and get a little license for them. And they had to do the same thing, but they did it annually. And of course, this is the British just imposing another tax on the Irish, right? But these records are fabulous because you get the name and place of your ancestor, but you often get the breed of the dog, the sex of the dog, and then sometimes even the dog's name, which is great. I wish I had an ancestor in there. But a number of other collections, right? So the largest collection of UK newspapers, the largest collection of UK military records. Our electoral rolls out of the UK are fabulous. We've done a lot of work with electoral rolls in the last couple of years. We have an incredible collection of school records from across England and Wales, and those are really amazing. You know, you get just kind of the registration book and it says this person was a student at this school, but then you also get administration notes and texts around how the school was operated. And it records things like, you know, these three brothers have been absent for the last 3 months. And the parents finally contacted and said it was because their father was out of work. And so they couldn't go to school because they were trying to support the family while he was working. Mm. So you have, or, you know, this whole class went to a local cemetery and went to attended a funeral this morning because this person in the community was so influential. So there's a lot of opportunity there for that history and social context type of research that we all love so much. We also have a handful of collections that are unique in that they tell the story of the broader British Empire, right? So one of those would be the British in India collection, which continues to grow with a number of different materials that we're publishing, both in the last year in 2021, but also in the next year or two. We're looking to expand that collection to incorporate more than just the European white population of the Indian Empire, but also including some of those other smaller populations. And then a set that I am particularly proud of that we actually published in 2021 is the Black Loyalists. Migration movement. So essentially you have, it starts with Lord Dunmore's proclamation during the Revolutionary War that people who were enslaved could gain their freedom if they came and joined the British Army. So you start with that and then you see the next piece, and these are all really small collections, but it took us a while to put it all together. So you see the next one is Black Loyalists moving into New York and then up into Canada. And then London Black Poor tells a little bit of that story. And then you've got a migration movement into Sierra Leone, where they're basically saying, okay, we now have all of these poor people living on the streets of London. Most of them came from the North American colonies as a result of the war. What are we going to do with all these people? And the grand idea they came up with was to send them back to Africa. So, right. So they put them all on boats. Well, many of them, and shipped them back and started a new colony in Sierra Leone, thinking this was going to be Little England, right, in Africa. And it's in at turns an equally hopeful and tragic story kind of over and over and over again. But it took us many months to build those individual pieces so that you really could kind of make that full loop from a geographical standpoint, right? So you're really starting in Virginia, going up into Canada, all the way back to England, and then over to Africa. It's a fascinating story, and it's one that, again, will continue to grow as we discover more materials. But, you know, those types of projects have been really exciting. We're starting to work with the Endangered Archives collection at the British Library. That's work that I've been very close to, and I'm really excited to see it come to fruition as well. So telling the story of the UK, giving us a chance to research our British and Irish ancestors, but also understanding that the British Empire touched a lot of lives around the world, not always in a good way, and being really honest about that and saying, this is actually the truth of the history of the British Isles.
And I like that, you know, telling the truth, right? I think that's one of the big things that we have to deal with. History makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Well, not all history. Let me just say certain history makes people feel uncomfortable because they don't want to talk about it. They don't necessarily want to deal with it. And I think that's one of the things that we find, especially with these records, when you're talking about the Black Loyalists, you're talking about Lord Dunmore's proclamation in the American Revolution, and then London's Black Poor, and then thinking sending them back to Africa, right? That's something that, you know, these folks were, we don't know for sure. And I'm not sure how many people in the records you're able to identify, but, you know, maybe they were not, they were born in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And maybe their mother or father or someone survived the Middle Passage. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they understand or have a connection to Africa, which is one of the things that, you know, as I do my research and deal with that sort of, you know, colonization movement in the U.S. or trying to you know, send people back to Africa. How it's a little unnerving at times, because you're taking someone who knows this is their home and you're sending them somewhere else. And in the case to me of the Black Loyalists, just to make this point, you know, that proclamation gave them freedom, or at least the promise of freedom at some point, right? And having freedom was the ultimate goal. And yet doing that, because of the situation, they are now kind of, I wouldn't say pushed around, but they're, you know, they're moved to multiple places just so they could be free, you know, and it's a struggle, I think, with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you read through what that really was like, right? The idea that he just kind of issued this proclamation and then just assumed that everybody would just kind of be able to stroll into his camp and join British forces. Of course, that's not reality. These people were trying to escape slavery. So many of them died en route. You know, obviously many of them never made it to Lord Dunmore. And then when they did arrive, clearly he didn't think this through. At least that's my interpretation of the history, because he exclaims in his papers how many women and children arrived, and what am I supposed to do with all of these people? I issued this declaration saying you can join my forces. I wanted men. But then even those men that did come, they were never given access to weapons. They didn't know how to fire a gun. They didn't know how to be soldiers. So they were often put into situations of, you know, digging trenches and, you know, very similar hard labor conditions that they would have seen with their master under slavery. And so you have this really interesting, complex story of a people who are doing everything they can to escape this horrible situation. And then they walk into yet another horrible situation where they're met with people who don't really want them there. Of course, there's a lot of discrimination and racism inside the British Army itself. And then disease and the toils of that type of work. And then the idea of going from this climate of Virginia and then suddenly being dumped into Nova Scotia.
Right.
Right. Like, right. So there's so many different facets of this. And I, you know, it's a story that really needs to be told. And I think that there is a responsibility for those of us who have access to these types of records, that we actually do make the time and actually pull the material and say, yes, we can add to this story. We can contribute to this narrative so that the whole truth, the whole story can be told.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. And I agree with you. This is a story that needs to be told. And I hope that, you know, folks that are listening will go to Find My Past, explore these records, explore all the other unique collections you guys have as well. But I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about this latest release that you announced on January 6th of this year. And it is the release of the 1921 Census of England. So why is this census important for genealogists and for researchers?
The 1921 Census of England and Wales is one of the largest record sets available over the course of our ancestors' lifetime. It is the largest set that Find My Past has ever released, and it was the largest transcription, conservation effort, scanning effort that Find My Past and the National Archives have ever taken on. It's 38 million people across England and Wales, and it really captures a snapshot of history that is difficult to capture, right? If you think about what's happening in this time period, we've just exited out of World War I, which was the most traumatic, one of the most difficult periods of history, especially in the UK. They have lost, you know, thousands of individuals to the war. And then you go through this interwar period where you really don't have another major record collection of this nature. So the 1931 census of England and Wales was lost to fire. So that did not survive. The 1941 census of England and Wales was never taken because of World War II. So you've got the 1921 census, and then you have the 1939 register, which was taken just right on the eve of World War II, of course. And that is basically everything for that interwar period from a national standpoint. Wow. So you now have access to what I've been referring to as the two bookends of the interwar period, right? There's a number of collections inside that period that will help. Electoral registers, for example, are a great one. Newspapers, that kind of content. But from a national kind of population census-like collection, it's the 1921 census and the 1939 register. And so when you're looking at genealogical research in the UK, that's an area in which a lot of people get a little bit stuck because they lose their ancestor during World War One, right? That direct line. And we know that UK research is predominantly within about a 20-mile radius of their kind of their home parish, their birth parish. So this census really gives us a chance to study those populations and those communities from a completely different perspective. And also think about the population loss between the 1911 census of England and the 1921 census. Even when they took the 1921 census, the statistical reports will tell you that the 1911 census was almost irrelevant by that point because of the loss of World War One, because of the Spanish flu, because of all of these kind of major changes that are happening across society. From a vital record standpoint, from a population statistical standpoint, the 1911 census is almost, you know, irrelevant in its day. And the 1921 census was incredibly valuable from that standpoint, from a historical standpoint as well.
That's great information. I personally did not know that about the 1931 census. 1941 census makes sense, you know, because of World War II. What information will we find or researchers find in the 1921 census?
So you should expect it to be covering kind of the average information that a census will have, right? Names, dates, and locations. But some of the things that make the 1921 census unique are how the census was conducted, especially compared to the United States. So in the UK for 1911 and 1921, they sent the pieces of paper to the actual households. So if you find someone in the 1921 census, that is likely your ancestor's handwriting, right? They filled it out themselves on one particular day. And then the next day or within a week, the enumerator came and knocked on your door and collected the piece of paper. So the census was taken on the 19th of June, 1921, and it is a snapshot of life on that night exactly. So if you are at home with your, you know, three children, but your husband is away on business, he's not in the household because he's enumerated at a hotel somewhere. If you are on summer holiday, because this is June and people are getting ready to take starting to go on vacation, maybe you're not enumerated at your home or your address where you should be. You might be enumerated at a seaside village somewhere because you're on a little weekend getaway. There were a number of questions that give us a really unique view of the population as well. So there's a lot happening right in this period from a social standpoint. There's a housing crisis across England and Wales, partially because of the war. But in one instance, there's an enumeration where there's 22 people living in a house with 9 rooms. So 6 families living all together in one house. And you can see that on the census because they collected the number of rooms in the household as part of the enumeration. There is a census return that has an 18-year-old daughter who's been crossed out because she died at 8 p.m. on June 19th, which is the day the census was taken. So they filled out the census probably sometime during the day. She dies in the evening, and then they cross her name off because she's no longer part of the household.
Wow.
That's fascinating. Yeah, it's really, the fact that they filled it out themselves is really, really incredible, right? So there's political statements being written in, right? That because of the housing crisis, because veterans are having a hard time finding employment, you have all of these notes around, you know, why aren't you helping to take care of our veterans? You know, and they're directing these comments directly back to the government, right? Divorce was recorded for the first time in 1921. So there's a number of people who are saying, divorce is abhorrent. Why would you allow this? This is a horrible change to our society and our culture. But then there's just as many people with big, bold D's in the marriage column saying, I'm divorced and I'm proud, right? there's one return that I particularly like that is, there's a large tear at the bottom in the left corner of the census return. And it has a note next to it that's written in by the enumerator. It said, the dog did this. So it's like literally the dog ate my homework. there's a pair of genealogists from Massachusetts doing research at the National Archives. That are enumerated in the census. And I think that's one of the special things about it is that it's not just the population of the British Isles. It's not just people who are citizens of England and Wales. They captured everybody who was in sight that night. So if you were a merchant marine on a vessel in port and you were born in Poland, you're in the census. If you're at the Savoy Hotel and you're on vacation. There's a couple there that I've been looking at. They're from Detroit. And he was a manufacturer. Oh, that's right. You're from Detroit. they're on vacation and they're there with their one-year-old son. They're enumerated at the Savoy Hotel because they're in England on the 19th of June, 1921.
That is, I love it. But also with 1921 census, you get so much information that I want to dig deeper into, like, what does it tell us about diversity in England and Wales after World War I? Because we talked a lot about that with veterans and the housing crisis and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, we know from, or we would say traditionally, that diversity, especially in, so for example, the Afro-Caribbean community in really starts to see an increase after World War II. Right? That's traditionally what the thinking has been, that there's this huge population increase in England from the British West Indies after World War II. But the census actually shows us that there is a growing presence of African Caribbean community in London and other major cities across England in 1921, right? In that interwar period. So it actually really does capture a good look at diversity across the country. Of the 38 million people that are in the census, more than 1.2 million of them were actually born elsewhere. So there's 30,000, for example, from Canada and Newfoundland. And of course, Newfoundland at this point is its own colony. It's not part of Canada yet. There's 15,000 from the United States. There's 23,000 from South Africa. There's 75,000 people enumerated from the Indian Empire. There's nearly 40,000 from Russia and its former empire. And remember, right, that Russia is, of course, in the middle of its civil war right now. The Bolsheviks are starting to take control. So there's this huge population of refugees. Same for Poland. There's a huge Polish population. The one thing that I wish the census had captured was religion or ethnicity, but there's no questions related to that. But we can see, for example, populations of the Jewish community and start to pull together those statistics and those numbers across England. Russian Orthodox Catholics, same kind of study could be done, where you see large collections of refugees and Russian settlers or those of Russian heritage kind of congregating around the known Russian Orthodox churches across the country at that time. Another perspective that we have been particularly interested in is the what the 1921 census can tell us about the deaf community across England and Wales, and how they processed the actual process of the census, right? Because as we're used to in the United States, an enumerator would come to the door and kind of knock and take your information. But in this instance, we see specific examples where individuals are having translators stand at the door with them when they come to collect the household return. So the enumerator would actually note that the daughter spoke on behalf of the head of household because he is deaf or he is blind or he is mute. So there's some really, really interesting bits of information that we can pull from the census. And a lot of that can be found in the just the transcriptions that we did, the indexing that we did for the census. So from a statistical standpoint, the reports that were published, you know, back in the 1920s from the UK government are really helpful in seeing that diversity story. But it's not really until you get the household returns, which is what's now available, that you really start to personalize those stories, right? I mean, statistics are great. And from a historical standpoint, very important for our study. But the individual stories, right, seeing a household return of someone who is living in a barn, for example, as a Russian refugee, that's a much more powerful image than just saying, you know, 3% of the census or whatever it was Russian, of Russian origin. So there's a lot to be delved into still in terms of study and family history. But those, they really did try to capture everybody. So you've got everything from the royal household all the way down to the transients and the destitute who were literally enumerated as living in a barn or in a field.
Wow, that's fantastic. I mean, just to, you know, just thinking in my mind is going crazy here, thinking about all the information you could find and all the stories you can uncover just from the census alone and just trying to understand, as you said, the diversity of the population. The statistics are helpful, but the amount of folks, I would have never thought that there'd be, you know, so many folks from Russia that were enumerated or from, you know, the United States, right? Like the couple in Detroit or whomever else was on holiday or from Detroit. But you mentioned this earlier, and I think it's important to talk about this as well, is you know, what can we learn about the impact of the 1918 flu epidemic, given that we haven't been experiencing our own global pandemic? Not that any of us signed up for this, but it is what it is. So what can we learn about the impact of the 1918 flu epidemic from the census in 1920?
The impact is almost implied. And it's the flu epidemic of 1918 stands out because it's almost not addressed in the census itself, which is really interesting to me, right? Especially considering what we've all been living through. We've been talking about, you know, keep a journal during the pandemic so that your ancestors will know what it was like to live through this, or your descendants rather. They took almost the opposite approach at the time, especially in the UK, right? It was more of like an individual duty to just carry on and not document and not record that struggle. It's really interesting. But one particular part of the census that I think is really going to be insightful here is the question around children. So for every child that was 16 and under on the census, they had to document whether their parents were both still alive or if they were an orphan. And they actually specifically said, document if your father is dead, your mother is dead, or if both are dead. So we can see that obviously World War I combined with the flu epidemic would have created, you know, a huge number of orphans across the country. And that is, of course, the case. But we also have the opportunity to research institutions, right? Hospitals were enumerated, just like everything else. So the population is fighting kind of the tail end of the epidemic, but also typhoid and polio and all of these other kind of diseases and conditions that we generally, you know, kind of take for granted now, right? Because we have cures, we have reasonable way to move around those. And they were still very much, you know, in the midst of typhoid was a big one. So you see the hospitals being enumerated, and then the children's homes, right? And the orphanage were all also enumerated. So, and by name, right? So you have a one-year-old and a three-year-old right next to a 16-year-old saying, I'm in this children's home. There were certainly some behavioral changes. So there's one census return in particular that we found when we were doing the conservation, and the individual actually wrote on the document that he slightly damaged the paper because he tried to disinfect it before he filled it out.
Oh, wow.
And that obviously is going to be a direct result of his behaviors during the epidemic, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And it's actually got a quite lengthy note about how this is, you know, came from a process government facility and who knows how many people have touched it. And so he tries to disinfect the piece of paper before he fills out the census. So, you know, the Spanish flu killed around an estimated 228,000 people in the UK. But when you think about the time frame and how that aligns with World War I, that was, you know, a relatively small number, right? The war caused a staggering number of fatalities. You also have the fact that practitioners, doctors, physicians were almost more likely in Europe on the fields of war during the epidemic than they were at home, right? So you have this sense of kind of normalized death because of these staggering numbers coming out of the war. And that brings you to this kind of general population kind of saying, we just need to keep going. We just need to keep, you know, just another step forward, another step forward. The language, I found it really interesting that the language used around the epidemic in the UK was not the same way that we would see it today, right? We talk about the battle with COVID, the war with COVID, trying to fight COVID. That's not the terminology that they used with the Spanish flu in the UK, because the battle was in France and in Europe, right, on the lines. And so it was just from a PR perspective, it was done very differently at that time. I also found it really interesting that there's no public memorial for the victims of the flu in England. There's never been a day of like acknowledgement or recognition and saying, you know, we lost all of these people because of this epidemic. They just didn't talk about it, especially in that devastation of World War I. They just normalized, they moved on, they didn't dwell on it. And it was just kind of more of a matter of fact. We're just not going to address it. We're just going to kind of tuck this back under the carpet and we're going to worry about the war instead.
I find that interesting yet understandable.
Yeah.
And here's why. And that, you know, we talk, as you mentioned, the war against COVID, the fighting for COVID. You have a generation of folks that are dealing with the first world war, right? And not knowing we were to have a second one. So the Great War, right? World War I. And then on the heels of it, war, where you're saying where there's a number, you know, so many casualties in the UK, so many casualties, you know, around the world. And yet now we also have to deal with the Spanish flu, this flu epidemic on top of that, right? We've been going a little nutso being in our house dealing with COVID alone and other things going on in the country. I'm not discounting the other things we had going on in 2020 and that continue today. But the thought of the first World War plus this lets you kind of see, okay, you know what? They probably were sick and tired of talking about it. They wanted to move on. But the fact that I do like that we can, you know, the ability to see if the parents, you know, for the children that are orphaned, you know, mother, father died, the children that are in those homes that are, you know, babies, 1 year old, 3 years old, you know, up to 16 years old. And just understanding, I think that gives you a bit more of kind of the social history and gives and tells more of the story, right? Which is what we truly want, is to know more about the story just besides the names, dates, and location. With that, though, how would you suggest U.S.-based researchers, you know, use the 1921 census to learn more about their ancestry? Or actually, I'll toss this in here, if they're just kind of interested in a particular location, right? Maybe their ancestor came from a particular area in the UK earlier, right? And maybe they still have family there or they don't, but they're just interested in learning more about the impact of the war as well as what was going on in 1921.
Yeah, so there's a number of different avenues where I think U.S. researchers would find some really particularly interesting stories. And a lot of those have to do with migration. Right. So we see after World War One, we see a population of war brides that start to come into the United States. But there's much more of those after World War II. But if your ancestor was alive to get married in World War II, their families were probably in the 1921 census. So this is a chance to get the siblings and the cousins and all of those other relations of people who did not obviously make the trip over. We also have various migration schemes around these kind of bulk populations, right? Children are one of them. We know that from the late 1800s through about the 1960s, children were sent en masse out to British territories. Canadian home children is probably the most well-known example, but there was also several thousand that were sent to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and so forth. So these are children who were generally orphaned or couldn't be taken care of at home. And circumstances differ, of course, but many of them were sent to Canada and they were essentially adopted or brought into a home. Many of them were treated as servants. Many of them were brought in as part of the family. So every story is a little bit different, but there's millions of descendants across Canada today from that particular migration movement. There's also, after World War One, there's a significant recognition by the government in the UK, acknowledging that there's not very many guys to marry. So what are our women going to do? So they come up with this scheme to send women to various parts of the empire as well. The problem with that, of course, is that the different countries around the world didn't necessarily want just any old woman. They specifically wanted people who had experience in domestic service. But you're talking to a population of women who have now realized that I can go get a job. I can be a typist. I can have a skilled employment status. I don't necessarily want to go back into domestic service. And I don't really want to leave my country. I want to stay here. And there's parents who are saying, well, I just lost, you know, three of my sons in the war. I'm not giving up my daughter, too. So there's all this push and pull between the government and these various Christian charity organizations that are trying to help these populations, but at the same time are being perceived in this way that, you know, I don't know, if someone came up to me and said, hey, do you want to go move to Australia and marry some guy? I definitely would do a little bit more than raise my eyebrows, right? Like, so all of this is happening. So that's a real opportunity for people who are part of kind of that British diaspora to take advantage of the census. But there's also the study of DNA, of course, right? This is the first major census release in England and Wales where we have DNA as a tool. So you have a lot of people who are looking for descendants who are a match, right? How do I match up with this particular person? Well, just like any census release, this census will help fill in those gaps so that we can figure out that most common ancestor so that we can continue our DNA research and start to collaborate with our cousins across the ocean. So there's a number of different opportunities, I think, for the US-based researcher. From the idea of more of like a one-place study or a house history type researcher, there were obviously the census itself would be valuable, but there were also census reports that were published in 1921 that kind of go along with the census. And those are where you'll find most of the statistics. And we have published on Find My Past the report for each county. Now, there are several of these available kind of around, but there were a number of counties that had not yet been digitized. So Find My Past has the full collection now as a result of this project. And those are actually available for free on Find My Past. So you don't need a subscription to access those. You just have to register on a free account and you can dive into the official reports of the 1921 census and kind of play around with that county by county information.
That's great to know. So with that point of creating a free account and being able to access those reports, how can listeners learn more about Find My Past? Talk about this free account. And if someone's listening and want to jump on as soon as they're finished, what do they need to do? What can they have access to?
Sure. So the easiest way to get to know us is just to register on the site. It's findmypast.com. If you are listening from another point in the world, it will redirect you to the most local URL, whether that's Australia or the UK or Ireland. But the vast number of people will be on findmypast.com, I would think. Follow our blog, our social media accounts, sign up for our free email. We do release new records every single Friday. So we're the only major genealogy website that publishes records every single week. So that's always fun because you can watch for those emails and then just, you know, and make a determination, right? Oh yeah, I have ancestors from County Devon. Great. I'm going to take a look at what they released this week. Or, oh, it's all about Scotland. I don't have anything in Scotland. I'm going to delete that one for now. You can also obviously take out a free trial. We offer a 14-day free trial to play with the site and look through our research and our collections. You can also access thousands of free records on the Find My Past website just with a free account. So you register, you click the little boxes that tell, you know, what emails you want or don't want for that matter, and access those records. So the US Census, for example, is free and a handful of other collections just to get familiar with the site, figure out how we do things, get to know us a little bit. But I highly recommend if you're interested in kind of the British history angle or getting to know the company as individuals, we're a relatively small organization and we do a live Facebook and YouTube broadcast every week, at least on Fridays. We usually have more than that, but we almost always do a Friday session. And it happens at 9 a.m. Mountain, so 11 a.m. Eastern, every Friday. That is usually presented by one of the team of experts at Find My Past. And we just have a good time. We talk to our customers. We talk to our community. We banter a lot. We talk about the records we've released. So if you really want to get to know what makes Find My Past tick, that's really the best way to do it. And if you're lucky enough to catch me on a week, I go through that rotation. I'm just going to throw that out there as well. But we just have a lot of fun with it. So if you have questions about British and Irish research, the Find My Past Facebook page is a great place to go, as well as the Find My Past Forum, which is a group that's specifically designed to talk about British and Irish research.
That's great. I love that you have the Facebook Live every week as well. And then also I did not know about the records release every Friday. That I will definitely have to sign up for those emails and add that to my list.
I think technically we did miss Christmas Eve this year. Don't think we released on Christmas Eve.
That's understandable.
Thanks.
I mean, while people do genealogy over the holidays, a lot of times because they're around their families, we do understand you taking, you know, Christmas Eve off. But the fact that you do it every Friday, right, is great for individuals. And I like all the different opportunities to get to know you guys through the free trial. And also you mentioned, and I'll close here, with the U.S. Census records. I think it's important for folks to know while you do focus primarily, you talked about some record collections that were unique that are related to the United States when you're talking about the Catholic Heritage Archives, right? It's good to know that you have records outside of that and that even those based in the U.S., can still not only get records related to UK, Scotland, Wales, and some other record sets on Australia and New Zealand, but they can also maybe find a little bit about their American ancestors from the website as well. So thank you so much, Jen, for taking the time. I have learned so much today about Find My Past that I did not know about the 1921 census. I'm very excited. I had no idea how significant it was until we had this conversation. And, you know, here we talk a lot about 1890 and a woe is me on that. I'm not saying it's not woe is me, but we talk a lot about that. But the fact that you have, you know, just 1931's not there. You know, you have the 1939 register, and then you really have 1921, and 1940 wasn't taken because of World War II, is just fascinating that now so many people have access to this. And I think it's so great. And I'm excited to share this knowledge with other folks. And I hope our listeners do the same. So thank you so much for coming to Conversations with Kenyatta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com.